Last week, we heard the news that Pyotr Patrushev had died. Pyotr was my guest on Conversations some years ago. His story was remarkable, and in memory of him, we're replaying that conversation today. Pyotr Patrushev was a very high-level Russian translator and interpreter based here in Australia. He was the essential ingredient when our prime ministers met with Russian leaders like Vladimir Putin or Mikhail Gorbachev. The world of diplomatic translation is fascinating enough, but it was Pyotr's own story that was at the heart of our conversation. Because some 50 years ago, Pyotr Patrushev went AWOL from the Soviet army. He slipped away to the coast of the Black Sea, and then he swam out of the Soviet Union and into Turkey. And in Turkey, they thought he was a Soviet spy, and they threw him into prison. I spoke to Pyotr Patrushev in March 2010. Pyotr, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you, Richard.
Tell me what the difference between translating and interpreting is.
For translation usually means written translation, which I do also, and I've translated, you know, some books into Russian. But interpreting is usually live. It could be consecutive when you go after the person that's spoken, or simultaneous when you sit in a booth at an international conference and you just keep on translating whatever people are saying, interpreting what they're saying immediately.
I don't know how you do it. I figure you must have one half of your head to hear and another half to translate.
Yes, and the border between them must be totally transparent.
Yeah.
And you're either born with it or, you know, you just don't have it. You could have excellent knowledge of two languages or more languages, but to be able to actually almost in real time with a very slight delay go, you know, after somebody who may be speaking with heavy Indian accent or British accent and do a technical translation about railways or coal mining or whatever it might be, or space research or diplomatic translations, it's an art and a skill, and you have to have a lot of practice.
You have to hear things like irony and humour and nuance and all those things on the fly while you're turning Russian into English.
Absolutely, yes. And you have to be fast enough on your feet, you know. And sometimes, you know, you just have to also make sure that you translate it down a little bit, because if somebody comes out with a Shakespearean quotation and you're not quite sure how to render it, you just render the meaning, because otherwise you can get into hot water. And a lot of interpreters and translators did get into hot water.
Yes. Tell me how wrong it can go. How catastrophic can it go when you're translating and interpreting?
Well, probably the most catastrophic case that I know of would be the bombing of Hiroshima. Because the American military translators, when they translated the message from the Japanese War Cabinet to the American authorities, they basically did not convey the tone which could have been interpreted as being conciliatory. And so it came out very belligerent, like, we don't really want to talk to you, you know, bomb us if you want to, sort of thing. And, you know, so it's written in the annals of history now that was one of the crucial aspects of Americans making a decision. They probably would have bombed it anyway, you know, but that made it easier when they could prove that Japanese were totally intransigent.
Can the work be boring at times? Because you're dealing often with very long factual transactions about trade and things like that. Can it be boring?
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, and I talk about the kind of the ennui of the long-distance interpreter. You know, could be sitting for 8 hours talking about, you know, polar science, you know, coal mining and whatever. But, you know, it's in between, you know, it's being in the exotic locations, meeting really interesting people. And I have met some of the most fascinating people. Aside from, you know, important people and famous people, but they were just really fascinating characters met both on the job and, you know, when you're traveling to exotic locations around the world.
Do those interpreters sitting in those little booths sometimes forget that their microphone is on?
Yes, it has happened. Some very embarrassing moments, you know, when somebody, you know, one particular case, somebody forgot that the switch was still on and they commented on a very low sort of a neckline, the décolleté line, you know, of a female delegate. You see, and it went live for the whole audience. I think she may have thought it was a compliment, but it was certainly embarrassing. You know? It's very non-professional, so yeah, you have to be very careful.
Why do interpreters try to avoid being the first speaker?
Often, you see, I think in international affairs, there is always a little bit of unease when two parties meet. You know, I mean, it's a stranger, you know, we're kind of primates that are slightly xenophobic, I think, at a very profound level, you know. So the first impression of the contact you make, which is through the voice of interpreter, is very important. And usually people will listen with incredible attention in the beginning of conference or a conversation or an interview. And once they're relaxed to understand that, yes, it's another human being and I can actually make sense of what this Chinese, Japanese, Russian person is saying, they relax. So the second interpreter, you know, in a conference will have an easier job.
You came close to fainting once, didn't you, as an interpreter?
Tell me about it. Well, you know, some of the long jobs. In the past, there was a lot more political tension. And, for example, there were incredibly long, almost late-night sessions at the Antarctic Treaty meeting or something like that, because often there was a superpower confrontation between Americans, you know, the British sticking up for the Americans and the Russians and the East Europeans, you know, and everything becomes very, very tense. And it goes often, you know, into late hours, and you have to have your cups of coffee all the time, which, you know, will keep you kind of awake. Yeah.
Piotr, tell me about the village where you grew up. Kolpashevo. Tell me about that. Where is it?
It's Western Siberia. Probably the next landmarks that some people will know about would be the city of Tomsk, which is a university town. It's sort of halfway, let's say, between the Urals, which is where the Asian part of Russia starts, and the Far East, all the way to Vladivostok and to Chukotka and to Alaska. So it's just about halfway there. And the city of Tomsk is a kind of a university city, also a city of used to have very powerful kind of a military nuclear installations there. So all the military experts knew about it. Novosibirsk is the other big city. And that's where my sister, my pensioner sister, still lives.
Is it close to what, you know, Solzhenitsyn called the Gulag Archipelago, the Soviet labor camps?
Very much, yes. The Kolpashevo was on the doorway to the Narim part. Gulag is archipelago, it's islands, you know, there were many, many lugs, which is really a camp, from Kazakhstan to the far north, to Kolyma and all that. So Kolpashevo was on the doorstep to Narim Gulag, and we used to have prisoners being taken through our town. And so I knew a lot more about it, actually, although we never knew about the true scale or what the, you know, I was a child, really. I left that town when I was 14. But you had sort of an impression that something untoward was happening. But you took it, you know, I mean, that was part of life. There were criminals going through town, too. There'd be periodic amnesties and, you know, criminals would be drifting through the town, creating a lot of havoc. It was almost dangerous to be then at that time because often they could rob and kill people. So that was the, it was, you know, the kind of the environment in which I grew up.
Where did you get your water from?
Water was, there was a well and you had to pump in the well, you know, there was sort of like a lever. And as a child, you know, you had to just go down there and you learned very early that you just had to do that was part of your chores, you know. So you would go 10, 15 times a day, both to water your garden and for drinking water for the cow, for the, you know, whatever domestic animals you may have had, and carry it on your shoulder on a kind of a yoke that you had on the shoulders. So that was a daily chore.
When I think of Siberia, I think, you know, it looks beautiful in the summer and completely frozen in the winter. Was it like that in Kolpashevo?
It is like that. It's like Dr. Zhivago, but without the Laris theme and the candles, you know, but with wolves howling, you know, literally. I mean, you'd fall asleep with wolves howling in the background, you know.
How did you keep warm in those freezing winters?
You have a very good Siberian stove, which is like takes up a quarter of your hut or house. So it's, you know, when I look sometimes...
A quarter of the house is,
yes,
the stove?
Yes, yes, would be, yes, because that'd be often the house is one room in which everybody lives, including animals on a cold night. You know? And kids go to sleep on top of the stove, you know. And it would be an incredible thermal mass through which the smoke would travel and it would completely dissipate all heat. So when I look at, you know, Australian heating systems or British for that matter or whatever, you know, I mean, it's a joke that all the heat just goes out there, you know. Everything is given out to this huge thermal mass that keeps the house toasty and warm for the rest of the day and night.
Tell me how your mother used to prevent people from stealing her firewood.
Yes. That was a kind of, I guess, a favorite pastime of some of our neighbors because firewood was a precious commodity. I mean, if you don't have firewood for the rest of the winter, you just freeze, you know, or you have to go in the fire, you know, into the forest every day and get yourself some twigs, which is not very efficient. So she would put gunpowder, I guess maybe my stepfather would drill a hole and the gunpowder would be packed into it. And then there would be some kind of a stopper, you know, and we'd just sneak it in the firewood. Just
leave it in the pile.
Leave it in the pile, you know, and then, you know, we'd be listening at night, you know, and one night there would be this loud explosion.
So bang! Kind of,
yeah. You know, and it's somebody's stove going, you know, at least. and that would dissuade them from ever touching your pile of firewood again.
Your childhood, in many ways, was very harsh, Piotr, because your mother told you not to love her, didn't she?
She told you. Why did she say that? And everybody, because she said in order to survive, you had to be first and foremost a survivor. And you have to realize, you know, it's the war. It's Siberia, for a start. Father has gone to war and got killed within a month of my being born. There are two children. Okay, the government doesn't help you very much at all. So you're really subsistence lifestyle. And so, you know, I mean, you talk about love, you know, So she knew that. And I guess that was her motto for life. You have to learn, first of all, how to survive under those conditions.
You said your father died in the Great Patriotic War, I think they call the Second World War, don't they?
That's right.
And then you had two stepfathers. So what were they like as men?
They were, one of them was an alcoholic, as a lot of men were around me. You know, drinking was, again, a national pastime, as it still is now, you know, in Siberia, certainly, but in many other parts of Russia. And so they were not bad men. Even the alcoholic father, I think, you know, because he kind of suffered a lot himself, he went into what they call labor army, you know, where the people who could not go to the actual army because of some physical defect would actually have to work in a special unit. So, you know, he had this kind of a gaunt look of a you know, long-suffering Russian peasant, you know. And he understood me being a fatherless son somewhere. So he never touched me, although beating was, again, another pastime. And he would do everything he could with limited means and, you know, like he would make a little boat. He was a boat builder, actually, a fisherman and a boat builder. He built me a little boat, you know, a little Siberian dugout canoe, actually, you know, for me. And I felt very proud because of that. But, of course, there was always a strong demarcation line between us as the nuclear family and the rest of the world. And stepfather was a temporary convenience. You know, he could bring you the firewood. He would arrange the truck. But when things came to really to cookie was crumbling and then it came to a crunch, it was us against him too. He was going to drink all the money that he's made in the previous month. He had to get out. He would be kicked out.
Your mother would kick.
He would, you know, and like it happened almost, you know, twice or three times a year. Every time he'd go on a binge, and then there would be again reconciliation and another spurt of work and more, you know, a little bit more money made, and then another binge and, you know, separation, and so it goes on. Very typical.
How old were you when you left home? You were 14.
I left at 14. I finally had enough of Kalpashevo. You know, I read voraciously at school.
What did you read?
I read.
What could you read? I should
through
say,
the yeah. whole. Yes. Well, you know. There was not much you could read, obviously, in terms of like literature that you know that was forbidden. But I read all the foreign classics. You know, it was all the French literature: Balzac, Stendhal, Zola, Guy de Maupassant. You know, British classics. One of my favorite ones was Jerome, and you know, Three Men in a Boat. It was available in Russian translation. I would have been about 10. And I'm reading that book, and I'm laughing like crazy. I love the British humor, you know, that dry, leisurely sort of gentleman's humor. And my mother or my sister would ask me, what are you laughing about? And I'd read them a passage, and they didn't think it was funny. I said, don't you understand? And when I read it and reread it in English, you know, I realized, yeah, it's still funny, and it's pithy, and it's wise.
Oh, yeah. So you're reading this English comedy of manners.
Yeah.
In a frozen little village, yeah, in the middle of Siberia.
Absolutely.
As a boy.
Yes. And I dream about, you know, being out of it somewhere else where the world is not so hostile in some ways, you know, where it's just more interesting, you know.
Was Stalin dead by then?
Stalin died when I was a school child, yes. So by the time I left Kalpashevo, Stalin was dead.
So you don't remember the cult of the personality around Stalin?
Oh,
then?
You do. You could not escape it, you know, because you have your loudspeakers on just about every telegraph pole, you know, so the radio, you know, like 702 version of the Russian National Broadcasting Radio would be playing either classical music or giving propaganda lectures or glorifying Stalin. So you couldn't escape from it, you know. And when you tuned in your little domestic radio, it just had one station again. It was the same station. It had the same propaganda.
So getting out of home at 14, where did you go, Pyotr?
I went into a college in a neighboring city of Tomsk, which, as I mentioned, is a university city, just simply to get out from that kind of stifling atmosphere. And then the much bigger world opened for me. And I immediately found a way of getting into a library where, through some mutual friends, I could get, for example, already, you know, pretty much forbidden literature. You know, it was a medical institute library, actually. And I had some friends who were studying in the institute. And so I could then lay a hand on the pre-revolutionary literature, you know, on sociological literature and some of the translations which were unavailable otherwise. And, you know, incredible horizons opened for you. And then I started listening to foreign radio stations. I would listen to the BBC. Never ever dreaming that one day I'd be in London, you know, broadcasting to Russia from the other side of the microphone.
Oh, so these horizons are opening up, but there have to be secret horizons. And do you have to keep them secret from just about everyone?
Although right about the time when I was ready to kind of leave Russia, in a sense, you know, it was Khrushchev's time. So the jokes, the political anecdotes were galore, you know. Everybody was sharing those jokes. Mind you, if you shared them in the wrong kind of company, you would still suffer. And later on, there were some repercussions for me, I think, because I loved telling this kind of forbidden jokes. But it wasn't that kind of paranoid, you know. It's Siberia, you know. It is in Moscow, probably people were more careful, you know. We are the hunters, you know. We're people who live with the nature. We can't be completely shackled into official ideology.
And yet you live in probably the most landlocked part of the world, anywhere in the world, really. Smack bang in the middle of the Eurasian continent, you become a swimmer, a champion swimmer, in fact.
Yes.
I've seen photos of you from that time, and you had this swimmer's physique, and you were... What did that do for you then? Because athletes were accorded all sorts of privileges, weren't they?
It was tremendously important. You know, if you became a good college swimming champion, which I did become, it opened up the doors for you. You know, A, you didn't have to go to any political lectures at the end of the day. You were going to the training camps, you know, in exotic locations. You were going to competitions in Moscow and other cities. You were given, you know, it sounds minor, you're given food coupons to a very good cafeteria, you know, where you were able to get really good food. You know, it was just different lifestyle altogether.
So how did you begin that training? And did that take you into the army?
Well, what happened was that once I finished the college, you had to go to work. And I tried to get enrolled at the university and just didn't succeed because of the timing and documentation and all that. And at that time, I was drafted into the army. But I was promised that I would only serve in the military club, sports club, which is sort of, again, a lot of elite institutions where a lot of Olympians were sports people who were in the army. They were professional at that time. Professional sport wasn't allowed. So, you know, if you're an officer in the Soviet army, you could then be a hockey player, you know, a swimmer, whatever. And a lot of Olympic champions were prepared in military sports club. So that was my way out because I didn't like the army. I didn't like the whole thing about militarism. You know, I read Bertrand Russell, you know, and Camus and all that. It was my youthful rebellion. It was directed against sort of the establishment in the army. And so that seemed to be a nice little compromise because there was no alternative service in the Soviet army. If you disagreed going into army, you're going 8 years in hard labor, you know, in the military jail, not in the civilian jail, okay? So so I got enrolled into one of those military clubs, but then possibly because of my love for anti-Soviet jokes, possibly of some other innuendos which I don't know, they put me into an ordinary military unit. And that's where you hear about hazing and the bullying, you know, which only now we hear the drastic cases, you know, where people get killed and all that. And so I became a target of one particular sergeant. And it came to the point where, you know, I was going to get maimed or killed or I had to get out.
How did you decide to escape? How did you actually then go about that?
So, you know, so in a sense, you know, I have this kind of like a dream almost, you know, which is since my childhood, since I was reading this foreign literature, of getting out, you know, getting. But, you know, it's impossible. So somehow, you know, you can think about life or fate that directs you in a way through these incredible confrontations with fate. I could have been maimed or killed in that hazing incident because what they would use, for example, they would use a felt boot, you know, in Siberia, well, where this felt boot, they would put a brick into it. And, you know, a number of soldiers will come up as you walk into the bedroom at night, okay, will overpower you and hit you on the kidneys with the felt boot in which a brick is positioned, you know. And you would be crippled for life. You'd be spitting blood, you know, and nothing, no bruises would be left or anything like that, okay. So that's the sort of pulling and hazing we're talking about. So I had to immediately get out from that situation, which was life-threatening.
Okay. So how did you do it?
So I knew that, you know, we went into the kind of like, at the point where I thought the night was going to be dangerous, we went into a dining hall. And what I did was to step on a glass and get a splinter of a glass, okay, under the table and put it into my food, or a couple of splinters. And then I pretended to be in pain, and I came up to the delivery dock, you know, where the food was being given, and said, I must have swallowed some glass, I'm feeling pain, you see. And, you know, they're not easily perturbed, the cooks in the Soviet army, but when you show them a splinter of glass and, you know, you're clutching your stomach, they immediately call ambulance. And so I was taken out from that dangerous situation in an ambulance, you know, kind of with a wailing siren, into a normal hospital.
Away from this officer that was targeting you?
Away from that officer. That night was a dangerous night, and I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you if it were otherwise.
Then you had to pretend to be paranoid.
That's right. So, of course, you know, a cut intestine is not enough to get out of the Soviet army. You had to lose a limb, or you had to have some kind of a mental disability that would make you dangerous being in the army. Paranoia is one of those things, okay, because you could get, you know, you could get your weapon, you know, a service weapon, and shoot your comrade. And it happened many times, sometimes in the cases of bullying, sometimes in the cases of real paranoia. So I had to then make a decision that the only way not to come back in that environment again and get out of the army altogether, because this was just the beginning of the journey, of 3-year journey, was to feign a malinger, a mental disease.
So how did you do that?
So it was a very difficult decision, because when you begin to malinger, you are prone to be sent again for 8 years of military jail for malingering. And or beaten up senseless.
So you had to be real. You had to be very, very good.
And then I became grateful that when I was with these medical students, you know, when I told you that I was getting forbidden books out of a medical institution library, and they were sort of like playing with pacifism too, and read Bertrand Russell and Camus and all that, and we tried to help a few people to get out of the army.
So you knew how to fake.
I knew how to fake. I read some of the psychiatric manuals that were given to psychiatrists only. And I knew how they were looking. They call it dissimulation, you know, how to actually determine whether a person is...
What did you say? What sort of things did you tell them?
So, well, it had to be dramatic. So, when the morning physician came up to me and he said, how are you feeling? I said, well, I would have been well, you know, but if it wasn't that they were trying to kill me. And he said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, you know, I know that I can only drink water out of the tap. It's still written in my history of my disease, you know, because I know that's the only thing that's safe, tap water. What do you mean? And of course, then again, they get concerned. You see, there's a soldier who sounds like a paranoid. And so another ambulance comes up and takes you to, again, a special establishment where psychiatrists will set upon you to find out if you're a real paranoid.
So did you start making wild claims then about people trying to get you? What did you say?
What I did, you know, the paranoia was, yes, sort of, you know, that, they were trying to poison me, you know, they were trying to put, you know, and I was hearing some voices and all that sort of thing, you know, threatening me and all that, the typical kind of paranoid schizophrenia. But also, you know, it was kind of, you had to choose something that was, you know, you had to kind of couch your real views in a way, because you can't completely invent. You know, they're clever people, you know.
And some guy was trying to kill you anyway, wasn't he?
That's right. It wasn't all quite paranoid. You know? So you had to talk about, you know, the facts of, you know, because I was anti-army, you know, and it was kind of, it became fun almost, an exercise of cheating this military psychiatrist, so, one of whom wrote a learned paper on my case, you know. And so, you know, you had to, for example, one of my theories was that Soviet Union should completely disarm. We're such a superior society. We're wasting all that money on nuclear weapons and armaments, you know. We're a superior society. So in the same way in which ancient Rome was kind of assimilated the Huns into it, you know, because they were superior civilization. We could just invite Americans, you know, and they'll come, they'll see the glory of socialist way of life, you know, and embrace it. And so everybody would be chuckling, you know, and saying, well, this guy is mad.
And you're chuckling on the inside.
I'm chuckling on the inside.
How did you then escape from there to the Black Sea coast?
Another bottleneck, you know, that's another point where I could have perished again, because Tomsk Psychiatric Institution number 303 is a closed institution. I don't have the exact statistic, but I don't think anybody had ever escaped from it. Fortunately, my medical students, by that time when I was already through my malingering experience, some of them already working as orderlies, you know, doing their postgraduate practice in that particular clinic. I would have never got out otherwise. So they looked at my dossier and they said, you need to get away because they're going to put your insulin treatment, electrical shock treatment, just about the whole kit and caboodle of Soviet psychiatric madness was going to be unleashed upon you. And I said, how? Well, they said, there's only one way. Is during the lunchtime, the doors are open from the dining room through the kitchen, and the two doors are can be simultaneous. Usually the doors are double locked. You always have to go through double locked door. But when they bring the food in, that is the only time when you can break through. And so I did that. So, you know, with that essential tip that I was given, you know, I came up. You were still in your striped pajamas. You were still in your psychiatric pajamas. Psychiatric clinic is probably about 6-10 kilometers away out of town in the midst of forest, in the forest. So you have to get out, and then you have to somehow make it to town and disappear. So I sprinted through the kitchen, you know, with everybody kind of like moving out of the way, because when a mad person escapes, you could get killed, you know, whatever. But, you know, as soon as I was out there, the, you know, ambulances were after me and all that, you know, they were going to come and chase you. I chose then to go. You had to make these split-level decisions. If I would have gone on the usual road to town, they would have caught me. So I went on the railway track. You couldn't go through the forest. It was wintertime because in deep snow, you would die from cold and starvation.
Did you have shoes?
Yeah, you had. Yeah, I picked up actually on top of the pajamas because there was also a work group getting ready for work. So I kind of attached myself to it just a little bit on the side of that crucial door, and I put a little like what you see in Gulag and Solzhenitsyn, like a prisoner jacket, you know, because that was like used by workmen. They wouldn't have let me out because I wasn't really part of that group, you know. But I was able to kind of mix with it and got it on, and the felt boots, you know, the boots, because without that you also, you know, I mean, yeah, you probably could make it, but I doubt it. So, you know, I rushed out, and having chosen the railway track, and, you know, you had to go in the forest every time a train passes, not too often, but still it was somewhere where they would just didn't think of going, and they couldn't go there unless they hired a train or something like that. They weren't that clever, you know. Then I make it myself to the Tomsk 2 station, and now I'm still in the telltale psychiatric pajamas, which, you know, you're not going to get very far if you walk through town there. So I see a horse and a sleigh tied up to a wagon, and it's peasants that came up with their produce to sell their produce in town, you know, and I still feel bad about it, but, you know, I couldn't help it. My life was at stake. So I steal that horse and sleigh. I sit in it, and I cover myself with some blankets or some stuff in that, you know, so that my pajamas are not seen. And then I go into town. I ride triumphantly, you know, in a horse and sleigh.
Like Santa.
Just like Santa. And then you had to find a safe refuge. And fortunately, my former coach was a very politically liberal person. And he'd be the last person, you know, it wasn't even my current coach, you know, that they would come looking. They would immediately went out to check my relatives. And I wasn't there. So I was able to hide with my coach for a couple of crucial days, you know. And then finally, you know, get out, get proper clothing, finally get myself documents. A very long story, you know, for example, because I was really not kind of like a KGB political person that would be put in the psychiatric institution on clear dissident credentials. You know, I was just a draftee.
You were just a mental,
who was crazy.
Mental patient, right.
That's right. So my brother was called out by the chief psychiatrist, who said, your brother is either very crazy or he's a malinger. Either way, he's going to be back here, he said. But I want to get him off my books because I'll go to jail if he's if he's crazy and he kills somebody. You know, I have allowed this escape to happen. You sign this paper saying you become a custodian for your brother and you take full responsibility for everything he does. Yeah, and then we'll see what happens. So my brother signed up for me. And I was able to get them, the, you know, normal discharge papers and all that. However, that was just, you know, the beginning of it, because I was young and I was silly. You know, I began to train again. And I began to train in a city swimming pool where the coach whom I abandoned, a very jealous woman, I didn't know that her husband was a military person, probably a KGB officer. She began to spread malicious rumors about me that he's not crazy. He's a malingerer. He just, he ridicules our whole system and he's got to be put behind bars. So I had to get out from that town immediately not to be an irritant to her. And that's how I got to Batumi.
Batumi, on the Black Sea coast.
Yes.
In what is now, Ukraine, I suppose, or...
It's independent, it's sort of Georgia and the Republic of Abkhazia and Adjaria, and it's a traditional point of getting out of Russia, really, since the revolutionary, pre-revolutionary, revolutionary times.
But you don't have a boat, and a boat would be caught, and you had to swim. Absolutely. And you were strong enough to swim.
Absolutely, I could swim. It's really, it's a corner of the Black Sea. It's a channel swim. It's 35 kilometers, because you have to get out into the sea, make a kind of an arch, and come back again. But it's a channel swim with obstacles. You could do, a lot of people can do channel, okay? But you try to do a channel when there are patrol boats. There are many powerful searchlights, where there are nets, where there are sonar devices, where there are overhead planes checking up, where, sonar device will pick you out if you're swimming with scuba gear, for example. If anything goes in the same direction and they see it on a sonar device, if it's at night and they're too lazy, and they think it could be a dolphin, it could be maybe a swimmer, they'll just send a plane with depth charge and just drop that depth charge in that vicinity. And in the morning, leisurely, they'll come and check out what's floated on the surface.
So it's like the Berlin Wall at sea,
it's
essentially.
Worse than Berlin. It is strict. Later on, I went to Berlin Wall. I went to the gates, and I went to Charlie checkpoint, looked at the museum where all these kept. Incredibly ingenious, But in terms of sheer obstacles, that was, it was like Berlin Wall combined with a kind of Everest.
So, Piotr, take me through how you did this extraordinary swim from this town of Batumi in the Soviet Union to Turkey, which is a NATO ally. Tell me how you did that swim.
Yeah, you had to prepare. You had to read your maps. You had to know when the searchlights go on. You had to go on and go off. You had to find out a safe place to get into the water within, before the border guards really begin to, patrol.
So you went there and just studied for a while, did you?
Because I became part of the local swimming team. We were training to go to Moscow for a major competition. And because of that, because they needed backstroke swimmer, like 100, 200 meters with my kind of times, you bypassed all the usual checks. They finally came up later on, But in the beginning, I got signed up. I got an engineer's job in a local factory, and I was training full time. And in that, both training, physically getting prepared, and also finding out anything I could find out, how to get out. And then one day, the time came up, and there were some tips, that I was going to be arrested, that there were, there was one interview already with the KGB, they called me out, they just felt me out, and I thought maybe just like initial interrogation, whatever, but it would have taken them another 10 days to get the full story.
What does that mean? You leave at night?
Yes. During the day, you cannot, immediately you'd be picked up by, So at night, you had to bypass all this. I think there were 8 powerful searchlights near the shore. And then further on, there are patrol boats. Okay. And you had to go between the sunset, when, just get in the water just before the searchlight goes on, swim far enough away so that the arch of the searchlight passes quicker over you, and then go through all these searchlights. Not to get far enough away outside into the ocean, into the sea there, so that the patrol boats will pick up, because they go without lights sometimes, unpredictably turning on lights, and all of a sudden the light is right on you. Searchlights, you can see where they are. So you had to react instantly to all of these dangers. You had to you really had to be like an animal, really. You had to do all your preparation, and then you had to react instantly.
So once you got in the water, what could you take with you? You had your swimmers, and what else?
You had your swimmers. You had your waterproof packet, in which your essential documents would be, your military tickets, my discharge papers. For some reason, I thought I'd need my discharge papers. My diploma, my swimmers, kind of what they call qualification ticket, like my swimmers' credentials. And all just packed in tightly, waterproof packet, stuffed into my swimming trunks to give me complete sort of, so that, I'm streamlined.
And a needle.
And a needle. And a long needle, because you're aside from border guards, your second biggest enemy is a cramp. And it's probably, as good, because it'll kill you, If you ever experience cramp when you're swimming, boom, you're gone. So the theory is, thank God I never had to try that, but the theory is that you pierce, usually it's a calf muscle, and so you would pierce it. If it's a calf muscle, you pierce that with that long needle, it sends a shock, a strong impulse into your brain, and it releases the cramp.
Whew.
Yeah,
Then you got a sore leg.
You got a sore leg, but you know, compared to drowning or being captured.
So you go out, you're out in the water at sunset. You're evading on the outer point of the arc of the searchlights, as yes. you say, but before where the patrol boats are.
Yes.
And you swim,
yes.
and you swim,
yes.
and swim, yes. and swim. All night?
You swim until you begin to feel that you're coming to the last searchlight already, because, you know, I mean, you lose count, you lose orientation a lot, you know, but you still kind of think you know where you are. You know, also because you get slowed down by currents, and there were some cold currents and, you know, and terrible currents, you know, lots of people who swam drowned, that I won't make it in time through the last searchlight, which appeared to be the last searchlight. So I could be already in Turkish territorial waters, but if it's a crack of the dawn, the Soviet patrol boats will go there and pick you up. The Turks don't guard their border very well at all, you know, and, you know, you're back where you started, you know. So I had to make my way to the shore no matter what. Again, instant decision, instinctive decision. The only way to survive now is get to the shore. Maybe you're going to survive there for that day in the bush somewhere, and the next night you can complete the last leg. And fortuitously, and I, for years I never disclosed that, okay, because I thought maybe somebody is going to repeat my swim, you know, because actually, you know, there are legends about my escape, not only, but in all the prison camps where hundreds and thousands of people are jailed for trying, not just Batumi, but escape anywhere out of the Soviet Union. So my escape was something that they held as a kind of a beacon, you know, this guy made it, you know.
So at the end of the first night then, you sneaked back into the the Soviet shore or Turkish?
It looks like the last searchlight is ahead of me.
Yeah.
And I could make it before the daybreak, okay. So I presume I'm in the Soviet territory. I swim into a little cove and I see, it seems, I mean, there's not much time to kind of investigate it, but it seems like a metallical shining body. Later on, I think it's a submarine. I'm in a military base. I'm in a Navy base, submarine base, okay? So I just pull up into that, and it later on, it was actually supported by one of the border guards who was on the border and then defected to Turkey. And so I hide myself in the crevasse of the rocks. Now, if I was in any normal part of the border, the chances would be that the patrol guards with dogs who continually patrol the border, and they already knew that I escaped because, you know, I was being watched before I escaped, would have caught me. The dogs would have got you. But it's a Navy base. Incredible stroke of luck. Unbelievable stroke of luck. You know, not patrolled by normal border guards. So nobody bothers me during that night. Of course, I get dehydrated, you know, and I'm even more tired, and I still have to go out for the last searchlight. It's another, you know, 5 kilometers to the sea, a big arch, and then onto the Turkish coast. So by the next crack of dawn, the searchlight is behind. I think I'm drowning, and I feel like my knees are scraping on the sand. And I come out, and by that time you get very, very careful. I'm 99.999 sure that I'm in Turkey, but I don't want to take any risks. Okay, so I still hide. I want to jump up with my remaining strength. I want to say, I've made it, but you can't. Okay, so I go, I hide again in the bushes. I crawl up to a little creek where I drink a bit of water because I was totally dehydrated. Actually, it's worse than just about anything else, was dehydration. You can't drink the seawater. And then I raise my eyes, and there's a little boy, probably 6-year-old boy, on the other side of the creek. And you look at them, and he could be, you know, a Nigerian little boy, a Georgian boy, you know, a Turkish boy. They all look the same in ragged clothing, you know. And I spoke to him in Russian because what have I got to lose now? Nothing, you know, and I didn't know enough Turkish anyway. And he ran away without saying a word, not getting me.
And you still don't know where you are.
I still don't know where you are. There isn't a cigarette butt. There isn't a piece of newspaper. There isn't a telegraph pole anywhere, you know. So you had to presume you are in the Soviet Union. And so I go up the creek so that the dogs cannot pick up the trail, you know, through the rough, rough, rugged terrain, probably 20 kilometers into the mountains until I come up. And at night I can hear the muezzin, you know, coming up below me, you know, already in Turkey, obviously, singing the winter prayers.
From the mosque, the night prayers, from the
minaret.
So you're in Turkey?
I'm in Turkey. And then I just breathe a sigh of relief. And I find a little hamlet in the mountains. And I knock on the door, you know. By that time, I'm 101% sure I'm in Turkey. They don't open the door. They wouldn't open to you at night to a stranger who doesn't even speak Turkish, you know. So I crawl up on the little loft. I'm very relaxed and peaceful now, you know. I crack a couple of eggs, you know. There was some chicken coop there, you know. I drink a couple of eggs. And I'm totally satisfied. I go on the loft and I fall asleep. And in the morning, the Turks come up and they pick me up. They take me to the border, give me away to the border guard, Turkish border guards, who immediately put me on a truck and drive me away from the border, because there was always a chance that the Soviet border guards would kind of try to kidnap me.
Then what? You're taken by the Turkish authorities,
yes,
but away from the border, which I suppose you're kind of pleased about.
Yes.
They must have thought you were a spy.
Exactly. I'm totally thrilled. I've arrived on the moon, literally. I mean, most people don't understand that. You know, you've done something like that. You know, you don't care about detail, you know. So, you know, I'm in Turkey. Everything's going to work out all right. But they take you to the next town, and there is this kind of a, you know, dirty little interrogation room, you know, with spots of fly, you know, flies on the window, portrait of Ataturk, you know, the torn out corner, and this officer puts the gun on the table and says a single word, "Jasus," which in Turkish means, you know, I didn't know at that time, meant spy. And starts talking to me in Turkish for a long, long time. So, you know, I see that I kind of almost laugh. I think it's kind of funny, you know. He doesn't think it's funny at all, you know. He starts banging the gun on the table. But then finally he gives up, and then an interpreter comes.
Were you interrogated and tortured?
Later on, I was transferred to a very high-level security jail in Erzurum, and I was in solitary confinement for a year, interrogated sometimes around the clock by Turkish intelligence officers who went through the usual, you know, debriefing, like what they would, you know, what they would use, all the tactics to crack up a foreign agent. Later on, I was told by a very sympathetic officer who spoke German. I spoke a bit of schoolboys German. He said, look, we've actually trained just about the whole of our academy, our security intelligence academy, in interrogation techniques on you. I said, thank you very much, because we never get people like you. But it was deadly serious. You know, a few times they threatened to take me out and shoot me. And you were totally at their mercy, you know. And when you don't cooperate, you know, and I was a cheeky boy, and I was 20. I've just made a superhuman kind of an effort, you know. And I think I can walk out of this place too, you know. And they start to ask me some silly questions. And I say, look, you know, and I was playing jokes with them and all that. But then it got serious. And I used my jail time to learn Turkish. I walked out from a year of that solitary confinement speaking fluent Turkish. Because Turkish is a phonetic language, easy to learn. Plus, I was listening to all these long interrogations. Plus, I converted a Russian-Turkish dictionary. I rewrote it completely alphabetically into a Turkish-Russian one. And then I could read Turkish magazines and, you know, study Turkish. And then I could check, and I said to the net, this is not what I said. That's how I finally ended up being an interpreter. The important, because my life depended on the quality of interpretation.
So you were there, freed into a detention camp in Istanbul.
Yes.
And this is like the 1963, 1964, thereabouts,
yes.
In your life. Did the KGB ever catch up with you?
I later on found out, already in Turkey, I found out that I was sentenced to death on charges of high treason, one of the very few, if not the only charge for a civilian person like myself of high treason, because of the sensational nature of my escape, and also because I immediately started to publish articles about psychiatric incarceration and, you know, dissidents and all that in the leading emigre newspaper called POSEF, published in West Germany. They were very unhappy about it. And so they, in no uncertain terms, you know, at one point in Istanbul, you know, on all I can say, I guess he was a KGB agent, because he came and spoke to me in broken Turkish for some reason, because we were kind of a crowd. And he said, if you don't stop publishing, we will kill you. And I said, you know, welcome. I know if you can kill anybody you want to, but I will not stop publishing. And that was, again, an instinctual decision, because if I would have shown any softness, any malleability, me and my relatives would have been subject to endless blackmail. This way they knew that I had to either kill me or let me go, you know. And I wasn't important enough for them to kill.
Yeah, and they would have killed you anyway, wouldn't they? They would have killed you anyway, you know, an umbrella tip in a public place.
Which happened to my colleague when I was at the BBC, you know, a Bulgarian broadcaster while I was in London, you know. They were very good at that.
So you've made the escape into Turkey, and eventually you came to Australia after all that. Australia. I mean, you chose it, I suppose, because it was about as far away as you could get from the Soviet Union.
As far away as you could get away from Soviet Union, already knowing that I was under death penalty. It was a country where they loved swimmers. It was, you know, Don Fraser and the, you know, John Conrads and all that. It was just after Munich Olympics. It was English-speaking country. I made up my mind, my second language, when I was in the detention center there. I learned reasonably fluent English. I said, you know, it had to be English-speaking country, far away from Russia, where they love swimmers. And when the Australian visa came up, I said, I'm taking it.
What was your first job in Australia?
Well, you know, there were a number of small kind of things. But ultimately, I was training some swimmers. And then I, in order to give myself time for study, I purchased a small dry cleaning agency in St. Kilda. And, you know, St. Kilda is still sort of a bit of a suburb, you know, which has ill fame. And even at that time, too, you know, I mean, it was quite interesting. It was very exotic that my main clients were prostitutes, really, who would bring up bundles of pungent sort of clothing smelling of these perfumes, you know. But they paid always on time. They never even, you know, they were really good customers, yeah. You know, and I would chat to them. And in the meantime, I'd have this pile of books, you know, I'd be reading Arthur Koestler and Bert. I was catching up on, you know, years of literature that I missed in the Soviet Union.
For a while, you worked at the BBC in London, too. You left it to go to work as a translator an interpreter over there. You mentioned a colleague whose name I'm trying to remember. Markov, was that his name?
Yes, Markov was a Bulgarian.
When he was assassinated. Yes. You could have been assassinated quite easily there, surely.
Yeah, if it would have been the decision that made so, yes. But, you know, it was. I loved London. It was a fascinating time. I worked with the most interesting colleagues, you know, both on the kind of Russian migrant side. I was the first Soviet migrant to actually get a job with the Russian Broadcasting Service of the BBC. Before that, there were old émigrés, there were sort of the old elite.
White Russians.
Russians, you know, who thought we were plebs, you know, we spoke this kind of contemporary brogue, you know, and all that. But then, you know, after me, a few other people came up and the whole mood changed. And a really intelligent, young sort of graduates from Oxford and Cambridge came up who loved Russia, loved literature. Loved working with us. And we created every kind of program, you know, it was just emigre fair. We did like a Russian goons show, you know.
Wow.
A comedy show, yeah. Yeah.
Back in Australia, at first you were kind of distrusted by the Russian emigre community in Australia, weren't you?
A certain part of it, yes, because I didn't fit any kind of stereotype, you know. I came up from this country where, you know, people are supposed to be starving and, you know, and it was very hard to get out of it and there was no one. I was like, within a period of 10 years, I was again the only person who got out of this. There were all Harbin immigrants from Harbin. There were like post-war refugees from Europe. And so I was a bit of a white sheep. Now I love them all. You know, I love the Harbinians. I love the later Jewish immigration. And, you know, and I can talk to them all because I don't have any parochial kind of attachment to any of that, you see. So,
Piotr, you've done a lot of work as a high-level interpreter for visiting Russian statesmen. You translated for Boris Yeltsin, for Mikhail Gorbachev. How about being an interpreter for John Howard when Vladimir Putin came? He scares the hell out of me, Putin. He's a scary kind of guy. Tell me what that experience was like, translating Vladimir Putin's speech for John Howard.
There were two levels. One is being a professional interpreter, you know, and it doesn't matter who. It could be Godzilla, you know, it could be Putin, it could be, you know, anybody. You still have to perform your job. The human part was, I'm here sitting across the table from a man who was head of the agency that would try to kill me, you know.
KGB, yes.
Yeah, right, yeah. You know, it was kind of humorous almost, you know. But of course, you know, a lot of water washed under the bridge after that time. He's actually quite a soft-spoken man, extremely careful and meticulous in his how he watches what the interpreter says. He speaks quite good German and, you know, some English. But, you know, it's all official kind of palaver, you know, so can't talk too much about that.
Okay, all right. you've got to be discreet. Yeah. How about Mikhail Gorbachev? Because while he's an inspiring figure, he's a deeply boring individual, though, isn't he?
He's very boring,
isn't he?
Especially in Russian, when you can see this regional, you know, a Stavropol accent, you know. So he was really elevated to that position where he could be who he was, you know. Almost anybody could be at that point, you know. But, you know, he was very personable. He said hello, you know, gave me an autograph, you know. He's a warm, simple person in some ways. But, you know, one thing that you've got to remember, I know people love Gorbachev, you know. But, you know, he was head of the Soviet Union when Chernobyl happened, and he didn't disclose it for about 3 weeks.
We need to remember that about him. Piotr, you're a fascinating man, extraordinary man. And just briefly, you've told your story in a book, and it's been published in Russia.
Yes.
It's sold out there.
Yes.
Is it published here?
No, No, it's my story in English has not yet been published, and
I waited till this time
to really tell to tell all the details.
That's an extraordinary oversight, I would say. You're obviously a great Australian. Yeah. It's been fascinating to meet you, sir, and thank you so much for being my guest in conversation today.
Thank you, Rich.
I recorded that conversation with Pyotr Patrushev back in 2010. Last week, Pyotr's wife Alice let us know that he died. He'd suffered poor health in recent years, and it's thought that this was as a result of his early traumatic life in Russia. Our thoughts are with Alice, his wife, his son Andrei, and his daughter Rima.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.